record number of women could be elected to Congress this fall, but there's a movement to get women elected at all levels of government. Getting women to run. We'll talk with She Should Run this morning. And good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, the She Should Run movement is coming to Jacksonville. If you're thinking about running for office, you won't want to miss this. Give us a call and tell us what you're thinking as we talk with She Should Run. The number 549-2937. Then later, a look ahead to this weekend's Pink Ribbon Symposium. Yep, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Plus, we'll also tell you about Stop the Crop. It has to do with those sign language interpreters you see on TV. Well, sometimes you don't see them, and that's a problem. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, women are running for office in historic numbers this year, many of them inspired by what's going on in our politics. The recent Supreme Court hearings are just one example. Now, the organization She Should Run is inspiring thousands of women at all levels of government all over the country to run. The idea is to level the playing field through organizations like She Should Run, which give women training in how to become a viable candidate for public office. It's important considering that women are still underrepresented at all levels of elected offices across this country. Now, there is an opportunity to be part of one of these incubators and learn how to run for office, and it's coming up here in Jacksonville. Sophia Pereira is Director of Programs and Impact for She Should Run, and she's on the line with more. Sophia, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. And here's our question to callers. As women decide to run for office in historic numbers, what do you think about that? Are you a woman who would like to run yourself? Or maybe you already are. What do you think about getting more women elected? Give us a call, 549-2937, as we speak with She Should Run. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa in Jax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. Sophia, you know, you have to go all the way back to 1992, the so-called Year of the Woman, which happened after the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill Supreme Court hearings, to see this level of excitement and interest among women running for office. And of course, the recent Supreme Court hearings around Brett Kavanaugh and his accuser, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, have brought back memories of that time. But it's true, isn't it, that women have been filing and running far before the Supreme Court controversy flared up over the last week. Tell us a little bit about the enthusiasm you're seeing on the ground at all levels as women look to run for office.
Absolutely. So She Should Run, as you know, is a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to expanding the talent pool of women running for office. One of our goals is to help 250,000 women run for office by 2030. So while, of course, there is a lot of great interest in 2018, we are really looking at where we're going down the road, making sure that we are setting women up for success and making sure that we are supporting more women running for office at all levels of government, whether they're planning to run this year or 5 years from now.
And we're talking everything from school board up to the House and Senate, president, every possible level of politics. You want to find support for women, correct?
Yeah, so there are over 500,000 elected offices in the United States, and women make up less than a third of those positions. And overwhelmingly, those positions are at the local level. So we need to make sure that women are aware of these opportunities, whether it's school board, water district, city council, that there are many different ways to make a positive impact in your community through public service, and local government or state government are really great places to make that impact.
And why do you think it's been so difficult for women to break through in the political arena? Women really do, I think, have to be encouraged to run. They don't tend to have the ego to just say, well, yes, I'd be perfect for that. You have to really encourage women to run. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a lot of reasons why that is. I think it's going to be different for every woman. Women lead in their communities already in so many different ways, whether it's through the nonprofit work that they do or through business. And it's really helping women to see that this is another place that is worth their time and to bring their leadership skills to. So one of our programs is our Ask a Woman to Run program, which has been a part of She Should Run since we started in 2011. And thousands of women through that program have been nominated to run for office, which has been a really important step. Like you mentioned, encouraging women to run is one piece of the puzzle. And I think a really important fact to note is that when women run, they win at the same rates as men. So this is really about getting more women to put themselves out there and lead in this way in their communities.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment as we speak with She Should Run. The number to join us, 549-2937. Now, in a moment, we'll tell everyone about an incubator you're going to be having in Jacksonville to train women that are thinking about running for office. But let me ask you first, Sophia, with everything that's going on politically in this country right now, how much is that driving this engagement and this energy among women that are now throwing their hat in the ring?
So I would say in the past couple of years, we definitely have seen a rise in interest in running for office from women from all different walks of life and across the political spectrum. Politics has definitely been an area where we haven't seen historically as much participation from women, but we have seen that change. And women are coming to the political table with different reasons, and but really recognizing that our voices at the decision-making table are really critical because we make up over half of the population.
I recently read a book called Broad Influence that studied the impact women make if they achieve a critical mass of at least 20% in any leadership tier, whether it's in the corporate world or in politics. If you can get at least 20% female representation, it changes the decision making for the better. You have a more well-rounded view of society. Mm-hmm. You bring women's perspectives to the table. It's really important. And so this is great that we're having you on today, Sophia, because there's a deadline coming up, I believe, this Friday for women in this area that want to be part of your incubator. Can you tell us all about that, please?
Definitely. So one of the things that we've been doing at She Should Run is really demystifying the process of how do you lay the groundwork for a run for office? How do you get more involved in your community? What are those unique qualifications that you bring that are valuable in your community, and helping to build a community of women that are supporting each other as they explore running for office, whether you're running next year or 5 years from now. So our incubator is our flagship program that creates that community. And we have women all across the country that are benefiting from these programs and online and offline. So we are bringing the incubator program that we have to Jacksonville, Florida, to your community so that we can help on the ground more women have access to these resources. So this November is when we will launch our Jacksonville cohort of women who are interested in running for office. This is perfect for a woman who is thinking about running for office but doesn't know where to start. That's really the starting place that we offer for women. So it's okay if a woman who's interested doesn't know exactly what they want to run for, doesn't know how they're going to get there. That's the work that we do, is to help you get to that place.
And so they need to deadline Friday night. Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes. No, go ahead. Friday night.
Mm-hmm. And they need to go to your website to apply?
Yes. Yes. So you can go to sheshouldrun.org and search Jacksonville, and you'll be able to find the application. You can also go on the sheshouldrun.org website and go to our program's regional cohort, and you can find the link to the Jacksonville cohort that way.
All right. And that deadline is midnight Friday. If you're thinking about running for office, if you're a woman out there listening to this and you think you have what it takes to run, then do it. Go to sheshouldrun.org and apply now for the incubator that will be held here in Jacksonville in November. It's a day-long training session and I think a couple of virtual sessions that will help you walk away with your next steps to plan towards elected leadership, and will also really grow your network of contacts too. All right, lots of calls as women run for office in record numbers this year. What do you think? Give us a call. 549-2937. Anne Marie is in Julington Creek. Anne Marie, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thanks. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I literally just decided on Friday, so I feel like this is serendipity for me, that I'm going to be running for public defender in the 7th Judicial Circuit, which encompasses St. John's, Putnam, Volusia, and Flagler counties. If I run and win, I would be the first female to ever hold that position. So I'm really excited.
Congratulations. Why don't you give us your full name and your CV quickly so people can just learn a little more about you.
My name is Anne Marie Janusa. I'm a mother to three and a bonus mother to two, so that would be five. I've actually been in Florida for almost 20 years and have had a private practice just as long. I do criminal defense work and a lot of family law, including divorces. And I attended school at Temple University in Philadelphia, and I worked my first 4 years as a public defender in Bronx, New York.
And who would be your opponent in that circuit? Who currently holds that position?
Currently, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Purdy. My understanding, and one of the reasons why I decided to run, is that he would be retiring at the end of his term in 2020.
So you'd have an open seat. Okay.
Correct.
And that's a nonpartisan office, am I right?
No, it's actually
it's party not.
Affiliate.
Okay.
Yeah, it should be, but it's not.
Okay. Well, best
office.
Of luck and congratulations. You should apply for this incubator.
I'm doing it right now as we speak.
Anne Marie, thanks for the call.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Sophia, that's exciting to hear. I think you got your first recruit.
There we go. And yeah, congrats again to Anne Marie for taking that step. That's really exciting.
549-2937 as we talk with She Should Run. Gretchen is in Fernandina Beach right now. Hey, Gretchen, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning. So I have served and I have run in a different state, but I was wondering, how could someone like me who has experience running for office and serving help others?
You don't want to run this cycle yourself. You just want to help other women. Sure. Yeah.
And I ran in it. I ran in Alaska, not Florida. But I'm wondering how, as a woman who has gone through this, I could use my experience to help others that are interested.
Sophia, your thoughts?
Gretchen, that is such a great question. And first of all, thank you so much for supporting the mission of more women running for office. I think based on your experience, something that would be incredibly valuable is to mentor other women in your community. Mentor even just one woman that you know would be an incredible elected official, and help them navigate that process. That is definitely one way. Definitely share your experiences with other women, because the more that we share what it's like to run for office, the more we demystify that process and make it more possible for other women to step up and lead.
And can your organization, as someone who's new to Florida, can your organization help connect me to someone that I could help mentor?
Oh, great question. So we are looking in 2019 to launch a mentorship program. So if you do go to our website and sign up to receive updates, we definitely can make sure that you get that information.
Great. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Yeah, Gretchen, thanks for the call. Sophia, providing that network of mentors and sponsors is so important because, of course, men have always been able to tap what some might call the good old boy network, but, you know, it's just a network of men in powerful positions. Women have had a harder time with that. And so you're really working to create that sort of network, aren't you?
Definitely, definitely. We want to make sure that the women that currently are in office or have held elected office are able to easily share their experiences with women that are aspiring to run for office.
And lots of calls as we talk with She Should Run. If you're thinking about running for office, you're a woman out there, you need to go to sheshouldrun.org by midnight Friday and apply to be part of their November incubator, a training session that they're going to hold in Jacksonville to train you to run for office. Lisa is on the north side. Lisa, good morning.
Hey, Melissa. One point that's really important to make is why it's important that women serve more often in public office is that in this time of incredible polarization in our country, women are more likely to reach across the aisle and work towards compromise. And we've seen direct evidence of this, even on the federal level, when we had a budget crisis a few years ago. It was women in the Senate, both Democrats and Republicans, who worked together to come up with a compromise that passed and allowed us as a country to move forward. I think that's incredibly important. And as someone who's been a candidate before in the previous cycle, I developed wonderful relationships with women on the other side of the aisle that were also candidates and relationships that continue to this day. I think that's a very important quality that's so important for our country to move forward.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that observation. I think she's absolutely right, Sophia. Women, we saw it in the Senate during that budget negotiation, and I think you can probably point to many examples locally and regionally. Work together, perhaps, sometimes with a little less tribalism and partisanship, which would be nice to see right now in America. Sophia, your thoughts?
Well, first off, Lisa, thank you so much for running in this past cycle. And yes, I think women, we bring a different perspective and a different type of leadership to the decision-making table. So really, the more diverse voices that we have at that decision-making table, the better outcomes, the better policies we're going to see come from that. So yeah, I think there's lots of really great examples of how women in leadership have brought a different type of leadership to the table.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Sophia Pereira, Director of Programs and Impact for She Should Run. If you're a woman or you know a woman who you think would be good to run for office, go to their website, sheshouldrun.org, before Friday night, and then enter the search term Jacksonville so that you can apply for the November Training Incubator here in our area. It's really remarkable to note that in November, Sophia, this country could elect more than 100 women to the House of Representatives for the first time in history. You know, when you look at the individual races, we're looking at between 30 to 40 new women poised to enter the House next January. That would set the or shatter rather the previous record of 24 that was set in 1992, the so-called Year of the Woman. That wave was widely seen as a backlash against the confirmation of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. And so as the Kavanaugh hearings play out, many women are angry about what they see happening. At the same time, a lot of men are angry because they see Brett Kavanaugh as being unfairly treated. And so there's a big gender gap in how people see those Supreme Court hearings. The numbers, though, as we talk about just the numbers, by November, Democrats in the U.S. House could expand their ranks by more than a third. The GOP's ranks could shrink by up to a third. That's not good news for the Republican Party. There are a lot of Republican women out there, and they're not seeing themselves represented on the GOP side. And so I guess my question to you is, are you getting a bipartisan level of interest of women that are approaching you and wanting this training or not? And what are you seeing out there in that regard?
That's such a great question. And I think to your point that we are seeing a difference in the level of engagement within the different parties from women. And as a nonpartisan organization, it is really important to us to make sure that we are bringing in women into our programs from all different political backgrounds, all different walks of life, because we do believe that if we want to achieve a more equal representation in this country, it's not going to be within one party alone that we achieve that. We need Republican women also at that table. So that's why we're working really across the political spectrum to provide these opportunities for women to run for office, whether it's at the local level, state, or federal.
Andy emails the show, having more women in positions of power is probably the only thing that can save our society at this point. It is vitally important to get women involved in voting in every election and running in more races from local to federal level. The demographic shift is moving too slowly. We need women to kickstart the changes that will transform our nation. Sophia, this sense of urgency that women and some men feel about this is really striking. Is that something that your organization, you know, you're a nonpartisan organization, but what about this sense of urgency that many Americans feel, particularly women that are out there volunteering on campaigns, running themselves? There's a lot of urgency and a lot of anger, I think it's fair to say, behind their political engagement.
I think what's been really interesting is over the past couple of years, the number of women that haven't been waiting to be asked to run for office. So while we do think it's really important to encourage women, you know, to run for office, I think the level of women that have just raised their hands, you know, unprompted and said, this is now a time where I have to step up and lead in my community and give back to my community. This is how I can make a difference. I think that shows a shift where, you know, not as many women are waiting their turn, so to speak, and stepping up, running for office, even if there isn't an open seat. And so I think we are seeing a shift in the way women are engaging in politics at all levels of government. And I think there is an urgency only for the reason that we need to make sure that we're having all of these different voices at the decision-making table.
We'll go back to your calls in a moment as we talk with She Should Run at 549-2937. Georgette Dumont tweets the show. She says, I am running for city council in South Jacksonville Beach because I want to make sure our community is the focus of our public decisions. Hashtag vote Dumont. Lots of women tweeting us that are running and calling us. So good luck to all of them. You know, Sophia, as I look at an analysis that was published last year, looking at why more women don't run, there are some really fascinating factors. It begins in childhood. Women really get discouraged from doing this. And then the gender gap really gets wider in college. Family and friends are more likely to encourage a young man to run for political office than they are a woman. We're talking high school student government, college student government. So that's sort of where it begins. And women tend to be more doubtful that they're qualified to run, more doubtful that they'll actually win. And then once it goes beyond college and into the professional world, even if women have relevant political experience and the right qualifications, they just don't see themselves as qualified, even if they are, with one exception being the local school boards of this country. Women are very well represented in school board offices. And so your organization, let me ask you, how do you get at the psychology of this? And how do you get women more in the mindset of seeing themselves as just as qualified? Because that traditionally has been a problem.
That's such a great question. And that actually really ties into and speaks to the approach that we take. So our curriculum is really focused on four areas. The first is around cultivating leadership. And that is really around getting the women that we work with clear on their why. Why do they want to run for office? Why do they want to contribute to their community so that they can, as a candidate, communicate that to others, help them to break down any concerns and fears around running for office so that we can address those barriers, whether they're internal or external, and also to help women recognize and really honor their unique qualifications. We are seeing throughout politics across this country different types of candidates running for office. And so really breaking the mold of what we expect a politician to be or look like, what traditional background they're supposed to have, what jobs they're supposed to have, what level of income, whatever that may be, really helping women to find what their unique path to elected office is going to look like, and that you don't have to have the same traditional background in order to be a positive contributor to your community. The other thing I just want to mention is to your original point around young girls and how we help inspire their political ambition and help nurture that. So a couple of years ago, we did a partnership with Barbie and through that partnership, we developed a parents course. So we do have for free on our website, sheshouldrun.org, a parents course that you can use that curriculum with your young girl. So that there's really great conversation starters and activities to help start that conversation about their leadership and help, hopefully inspiring them to run for office someday.
And as we speak with Sophia Pereira of She Should Run, give us a call if you're thinking of running for office or if you just think more women should run for office, 549-2937. You know, a recent analysis by Reuters, Sophia found that after November, we could see an all-time high of the number of women in our state legislatures, rather, about 40% if the majority of the women running win those contests. So that's remarkable, too, because women have always been underrepresented in state legislatures. That wouldn't get us to 50%, but it would get us a lot closer than where we are now. Let me ask you as well, with the Kavanaugh hearings playing out to so much intensity and closely watched and so divisive, the whole issue of abortion and Roe versus Wade, how much do you see that as motivating women to run for office this cycle?
I think it's going to vary for the woman that's running for office. Like I mentioned before, you know, we have women from all different backgrounds that are pursuing elected office, and there are going to be different issues that drive them. So that is definitely going to be one of them, but that's not going to be the only issue that a woman is going to be stepping up to run in their community. Most of the women we work with are thinking about running at the local level and some at the state level as well. And so there are going to just be a variety of reasons that women are stepping up to run. But I think the universal theme of why so many more women are running for office is women recognizing the value that they can bring to the decision-making table. So whatever the issue comes before them, that they are going to be able to bring a different perspective and hopefully produce better policy outcomes because of that.
Well, again, the deadline to be part of She Should Run's incubator is coming up this Friday at midnight. So go to sheshouldrun.org. If you're thinking about running for office, click on the magnifying glass up in the top right corner and then just type in the word Jacksonville. That will take you to the Jacksonville, Florida cohort, the session on leadership that She Should Run is going to conduct here in November. And you can apply right there. I think it's a $35 registration fee to get this valuable training session to build your skill set to run for public office. Again, sheshouldrun.org. Sophia Pereira, Director of Programs and Impact for She Should Run, on the line with us this morning. Thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely. And actually, Melissa, if it's all right that I chime in, I should clarify, applying for our program is free. And it's only a $35 fee if you are accepted. So just want to let folks know that if you are interested in applying, there's no cost to apply. We want to make sure that you have that opportunity to apply and be considered for the program.
Gotcha. And how many will you trainees will you accept for this incubator?
We are hoping to accept at least 30. I know some folks that we've talked to on the ground have been asking for us to make it a bigger group, but we found that roughly around 30 women is a good number for us to work with.
Excellent. SheShouldRun.org. Sophia, thanks again.
Thank you.
Later on the show, a look at the Stop the Crop movement. You'll be surprised what that means. We'll tell you about it. But up next, marking Breast Cancer Awareness Month with the Pink Ribbon Symposium. We'll be right back.
This is Ira Glass with This American Life, and I'm coming to Jacksonville to give a talk I call Seven Things I've Learned, which is basically just an excuse to tell a bunch of stories. I play clips, I play videos, I talk about how we make our radio show. I talk about stuff we have not put on the air and never will put on the air. And just play stuff that it seemed like it would be fun to play for a crowd. It's Saturday, November 10th at Florida Theater, sponsored by Community First Credit Union. Tickets at floridatheater.com. That's floridatheater.com.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. You know 630 City? It's the familiar place you go when you need to know. During severe weather conditions, our 630 City Call Center operates around the clock, equipping citizens with information they may need to make decisions and resolve issues. Be sure to add their number, 630 City, to your favorites, and remember to pick up a 2018 Hurricane Preparedness Guide from your neighborhood public library. Be Jack's ready.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, October is here, and as we welcome fall and those slightly cooler temperatures, it's also the time each year that health professionals mark Breast Cancer Awareness Month. This Saturday, a big event around that, the Pink Ribbon Symposium, is back. The 11th annual one of these. Can you believe it? It's one of the biggest events in the region to educate the public about treatments for breast cancer and also health and wellness and prevention. Dr. Linda Sylvester is the co-founder of the Pink Ribbon Symposium, and she's here dressed all in pink, by the way. Very nice. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, Melissa.
And this is a huge event each year that you hold at Thrasher Horn Center in Orange Park. It's gotten bigger and bigger. 11 years now. When you first started this, your idea was to just get information and resources to women, right?
Yes, we wanted a free public education to the community just about breast cancer and updates in breast cancer. However, through our evaluations from all the attendees, it has really turned into a new mission, and that is really of free public education for all cancer survivors and the community about health, wellness, survivorship, and also our special interest of updates in breast cancer. However, these cancer updates also apply to many of the other cancers now. As we learn more about genomic and molecular profiling, this can be applied not only to breast cancer, but to all
any
the
kind
other
of
cancers.
So men should come, and anyone who has an interest in this should come. It's not just about women and breast cancer.
Yes, exactly. We have
so men don't be put off by the pink. So tell me who's going to be speaking.
So our guest speaker this year, since everyone's interested in nutrition and health and wellness, and since we always love to promote our local talent and local professionals in the area, is Aaron Gottlieb, who is owner of Native Sun. And he will be talking about how he originally got started and how he also wanted to inform the public in healthy choices in foods and organic foods. We're backing that up with Kalo Nutrition, and Jill Legan will be talking also about how to improve your diet, what type of snacks to take, healthy alternatives to what people are doing, and understanding that everybody's metabolism is different as well.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier, a moment ago, just some of the research around cancer and some of what we're learning about how to prevent it and how to treat it. There have been some exciting breakthroughs in that space. Can you share a little bit about that, too?
I think one of the breakthroughs that has taken years to develop is immunotherapy. We started probably in the 80s and 90s looking at vaccines with Dr. Steven Rosenberg over at NIH and had some successes. But all of a sudden, we're looking at checkpoint inhibitors. We're looking at T cells. We're now taking patient T cells and actually removing it from the patient and then ferrescing them and changing its antigen presentations to recognize cancer cells in the patient and then putting those cells back into the patient. In the hematological malignancies, it has, we have people with 100% remission.
And that's amazing. So you're essentially, you're retraining the immune system to target the cancer cells, I guess. Is that the way to describe it?
Yes, it is. It's very exciting.
And it's taken a long time to get there, but now all of a sudden, that's how medicine seems to work. There's years and years of plotting and not figuring it out, and then this big leap forward. Is that where we are now with cancer?
And yes, and that's why we're looking into clinical trials with using combinations of chemotherapy regimens plus the immunotherapy regimens as well. So we have still years of clinical trial results to get and to see which is the best standard of care.
That's excellent. But for so many cancer patients and loved ones of cancer patients, the terror of this disease is so overwhelming. And what about prevention? Because most cancers can, not all, but most cancers can be prevented with healthy diet and lifestyle. But at the same time, everybody knows someone who has lived this incredibly healthy life and gets cancer. So it's the randomness of it, I think, that's so terrifying for people.
I think that's where we do have a speaker on genetics and family history. And you can do things to improve upon that. You can do prevention techniques. You can do mammographic screening. You can do your colonoscopies and see your primary health care physician. There's also the environment. And we have unfortunately poisoned our environment, some of our water systems, as we know, milk in cows. There's a lot to be learned.
When people come to this, what will they learn about simple changes they can make to their diet that can make a difference? Because wholesale changing your diet is so hard for people. Most people want to kind of ease into these changes. So what are some just simple changes that you recommend as a physician that people should be making right now to further reduce their chances of cancer later in life?
I think we're looking, let's look at the dishes that we use. Our dishes have changed over the years, the size of them. They're so much bigger, so we're eating a lot more. And I think if you even choose to a smaller salad type of plate and fill that up for your dinner, that would be one thing to use. Less of the sugar-containing drinks. Water is very healthy. And come and listen to Jill Leagan and talk about healthy choices as well.
Quit smoking, less saturated fat, less alcohol, more exercise, all of that.
And we do have Stephanie Brooks, who will be speaking of the importance of exercise, because we have a whole group of support groups that will be coming, and during intermission, Stephanie will be talking about how important exercise is, you know, even for just general well-being, but also during treatment, after treatment.
Also, if local nurses and medical professionals come, they can receive, I think, credits of some kind?
Yes. For the nursing credits, we're giving CEUs for healthcare professionals. So please come, enjoy, and learn, and celebrate survivorship in life.
That's right. It's the Pink Ribbon Symposium, the 11th annual, this Saturday, October 6th, kicking off at 8 a.m. at the Thrasher Horn Center in Orange Park. This is free. You will not see an event of this caliber usually be free. So if you have an interest in this, you need to get out there to Thrasher Horn. Dr. Linda Sylvester, the co-founder of the Pink Ribbon Symposium, always good to see you, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, recently here in Florida, emergency announcements used unqualified interpreters to communicate important information to the public. We're talking about sign language interpreters, the people that you see off to the side at an important news conference, making sure that deaf or hearing impaired people can understand what's going on. You know what I'm talking about. Well, during a Hurricane Irma briefing last year, some incorrect information was apparently given out via one of these interpreters. That's not good. At the same time, stations sometimes crop out the sign language interpreter from the screen, so you can't even see them at all. The Stop the Crop movement is trying to change that, and it's pretty timely given we are still in storm season. What's this all about? Here with more, we welcome Tyler Morris, Executive Director of the Independent Living Resource Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
Stephanie Monroe, Interpreter Manager.
Good morning.
And Dr. Suzanne Ehrlich, Interpreter and Board Member. Good morning. Okay, Tyler, let's start with you. It's called Stop the Crop, trying to get television stations to stop cropping out the interpreters from broadcasts. This is, I had not heard of this till you told me about it, but this is a big deal.
It is, especially when you consider the emergency announcements that are coming through. Past hurricane season, we helped staff interpreters for the Jacksonville Landing, for the shooting, for the press conference for JSO. And while these interpreters are being provided, news stations are often cutting them out of the picture.
And what reason, Stephanie, do they give for not showing the interpreter on television?
There's quite of different reasons. And oftentimes they're zooming in on a face and not considering the interpreter. And I think it's a point of conversation through this campaign that we can have so they can understand that importance.
Dr. Ehrlich, yeah, the television stations want ratings and they want an important, a good-looking image. The problem with that is if it's life-saving information, that needs to take precedence, I guess, over cropping out the interpreter. Is that a short and simple way to describe this?
Absolutely. I think part of it as well is that closed captioning is provided. So I think there is
some underlying assumption that closed captions are sufficient to communicating that information, so that if they have those closed captions, then maybe the interpreting segment is not necessary.
But it is necessary. And a quick break, and we'll keep talking about Stop the Crop. We're getting your tweets about this, too. We'll be right back.
Many places in downtown Jacksonville being considered for demolition or redevelopment have had their histories lost. How can we bring these stories back to life while determining a future for these sites? WJCT, in partnership with Modern Cities, present The Jackson, Forgotten Spaces, Tuesday, October 23rd at WJCT Studios. The evening begins with a reception at 6, followed by a panel discussion at 6:30. RSVP for this free event at wjct.org/events. Sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
Next time on The World, meet Jesse. He comes from a Mexican-American family. He's been incarcerated for half of his life. He was told early on not to mix with prison inmates who are not like him.
You know, we don't engage with them. We don't do business with them. And if you do, you're going to get in trouble. At least you're going to get beat up. At worst, you're going to get stabbed.
But that's not true in every prison. We go to one where change is happening, on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Lewis, author of the best-selling books The Big Short and Moneyball, talks about his new book, The Fifth Risk. It looks at the federal government under President Trump by focusing on Trump's departments of energy, agriculture, and commerce, and how unprepared they are now to deal with urgent risks. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
War, what is it good for? Try science. Neil deGrasse Tyson is no hawk, but America's best-known astrophysicist says many breakthroughs would not happen without military support and funding. Neil deGrasse Tyson on the dangers of this deadly alliance, next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
We're continuing our conversation now about the Stop the Crop movement. It's a way to encourage local news stations and networks to stop cropping out sign language interpreters from broadcasts. The Independent Living Resource Center is here with us this morning. Tyler Morris, it's incredible to me to learn that during Hurricane Irma, the interpreter that we saw on television here in Florida was not giving out, is that right, not giving out the best information?
There's been several cases, also in Tampa, and that's why at the ILRC, we're very particular about the quality and certification level of interpreters that we provide out in the community. Because if you have a moment where somebody's providing incorrect information in an emergency setting, it's as a hearing individual, a lot of us listening to the radio get our news, you know, from WJCT or turning on the TV. But some of these broadcasts are delayed. The information is delayed because, you know, people are waiting. Should they evacuate? Should they shelter in place? You know, is the shooter still, are they still active? And we have to, and through this campaign, encourage our stations to provide that effective communication by including that interpreter and making sure that that interpreter has the credentialing to provide that information.
And Stephanie Monroe, you help provide that through the Independent Living Resource Center, right?
Yes, ma'am. Everything that all the interpreters that we use for these news broadcasts and emergency services and things that are on TV, trying to get the information out to the people who need the information, they're all nationally certified. They all have a level 2 background screening, so there will not be instances where false information or incorrect information is put out to the deaf community.
And as you mentioned a moment ago, the most recent incident in this city where you helped police was after the mass shooting at the Jacksonville Landing, Doctor. You had a certified interpreter there standing next to the sheriff or whoever it was getting the information out. It's so important.
I was the interpreter
oh,
there.
Oh, you were so. The interpreter.
Was.
Okay, there you
it
go.
Wonderful, yes.
And here's a tweet from Lauren. I'm a sign language interpreter, and I'd like to know if this interview you're talking about now will be broadcast with captions so that our deaf community can participate. We don't have the capability to do this here at WJCT, which is indicative of the overall problem. You know, we're radio. If you can't hear it, you're not going to get the information. But you guys are going to caption this conversation later. Is that right?
Not just caption. We will also provide a sign language interpreter that will interpret all of the spoken information given.
And that's the key, to have both. Is that right?
Correct.
And why is that so important?
Well, it's different modalities for different needs. I always ask individuals to turn on their captioning and try it for yourself and see at the pace and the level of language that comes across in closed captioning. Can you keep up with that pace? Could others, children or other people who may not have be able to access the information from captioning still also have that great opportunity to have it through a sign language interpretation?
Okay, so it's so fascinating to learn about this movement. It's called Stop the Crop. If you hashtag that on social media, you can learn more. And Tyler Morris, what else is happening to get the word out about this? How can people be part of this?
We couldn't fit 600 people in the room today, but
yeah,
we have 600 signatures and growing this morning about individuals that are wanting change. And some of the narrative that's coming behind it on the reason why personally it's important to them is great to see. So, you know, jacksdisability.org is our website, Access and Stop the Crop. You can also find us on social media. But this is an important time for change, and we want to include our media partners in that change. And we have the groundswell asking for that in an advocacy component. And it's a simple opportunity of panning out, including our interpreters, and providing effective communication.
And if people want to become an interpreter, they can reach out to you to be trained too, right?
Yes, we can at least point them in the right direction and share with them the credentials that we're looking for.
It's called Stop the Crop, so important for the deaf and hearing impaired community. And for everyone, we're all safer if everyone's getting the best information. So thanks for shedding some light on this today, everybody. I appreciate you bringing this to our attention.
Thank you.
Thank
Thanks, Melissa.
We were joined by Tyler Morris, Executive Director of the Independent Living Resource Center, Stephanie Monroe, their interpreter manager, and board member and interpreter Dr. Suzanne Ehrlich. Again, it's Stop the Crop if you want to research that movement via the hashtag. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. Our theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. This is 89.9. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.